From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Nell Larson.
That's right. Nell is back. Woo-hoo. She was away on assignment traveling through Bhutan. She'll share with us her experiences of that trip, including its environmental challenges and what the country is doing to preserve its rich natural heritage. That's in the first part of the show.
And then, in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Dan McNulty about moose populations and trends within Utah over the past century. Dan is an assistant professor within the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University, and he's currently in the middle of researching why moose populations appear to be on the decline.
Yeah, interesting. And all that and a summary of the most recent release of the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report on Climate Change.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah, you don't want to miss that. It's the fifth in a series of reports from this volunteer organization of climate scientists, and it further confirms the fact that the atmosphere and oceans continue to warm, and we are the primary contributors to this event. We'll give you the highlights you need to know.
So, of course, you can join in on today's discussion by posting your questions or comments to our Facebook wall, KPCW This Green Earth, or you can email us at thisgreenearthradio@gmail.com.
The environment and our connections to it, that's This Green Earth. And it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Donations to Park City's Restore reduce landfill costs for residents and builders and prevents tons of material from entering the waste stream each year. And proceeds from resale of your donated items help fund Habitat for Humanity affordable housing programs in Summit and Wasatch counties. Restore is open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 6, and is located in Silver Summit at 6280 Silver Creek Drive. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch counties is a nonprofit organization.
Join us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
From going gluten-free to finding your balance.
From bike position to relationship alignment.
From the educational journey to navigating wellness.
That's Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, and Grand Valley Bank.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. Join me for The Splendid Table, an hour of lively and informative conversation and your calls about the first love in just about everyone's life, food. From in-depth looks at America's food chain to conversations with cheesemakers in the hills of Sicily, food is a doorway to great adventure. So join us. That's The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Join KPCW every Sunday morning at 9 for The Splendid Table, sponsored by River Horse on Main.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. My co-host, Nell Larson, is back from Bhutan.
That's right. I made it back to the U.S.
You made it back. Actually, I want to talk about just how do you get there to and back from Bhutan. What kind of adventure that is.
That's a long process.
All right. We'll get to that eventually. But we want to talk for the first part of the show about your trip there, your experiences there, what surprised you, some of the environmental issues associated with that country. Let's start with some basics about the geographics, things that I don't know, like exactly where is Bhutan?
It's funny that you mentioned that, because when I say like, oh, I was just in Bhutan or I'm going to Bhutan, I get like these blank stares, which, you know, would have been me not too long ago. But
Bhutan, Illinois.
What country is that in? So Bhutan is a nation.
Yeah, that is. It's a country.
It is sandwiched between China, like the Tibetan Plateau, of China and India. It's just to the east of Nepal. It's north of Bangladesh, but the only two countries that you know have borders with it are China and India. And Bhutan itself is really small. It's about 18,000 square miles, which is about the size of Switzerland. And okay. So it's a tiny country sandwiched between these two massive.
Yeah, it's kind of surrounded by India on three sides so,
yep.
And then China to its north.
Exactly.
Okay, so what's the general lay of the land there?
So Bhutan is in the eastern Himalayas. So it is super mountainous and hilly. And the best way that I could think to describe it is like one Cottonwood Canyon after another.
Really?
Through the entire country. Like, we think of our area as mountainous, right? But it's not like, you know, we don't have like these rolling foothills. It is like steep canyons, one after the next, after the next, after the next.
So no plains, open plains, grasslands.
No. I mean, there are like a couple places in the country. One of those is an airport. That's kind of the only place they had to put an airport in the country.
Literally, that's just one little stretch of flat area,
to... And they recently sited a second airport, but it's unclear exactly what's going to happen with that. And it's apparently, you know, another tiny runway.
Sure.
And there's one other flat area that I remember seeing while I was there. And that's an area that's actually like a nature preserve. It's critical crane habitat, and so that's not going to become an airport.
Okay, so but we're talking canyon after canyon type of mm-hmm. geography. What about the elevation? This isn't
so. There's
what are we talking about?
Yeah, there's a huge range in elevation. In so small country, but it varies a lot. So in the southern part of the country, it's a little bit less mountainous, and the elevations are lower, as low as actually like 500 feet above sea level. And those areas are like warm, subtropical, you know, really wet areas.
So lush.
Lush, really okay. Lush. But then in like 200 kilometers, you get to the Himalaya and you're up at like 23,000 feet.
Whoa.
So it's these massive changes in elevation. And that has like shaped so much about the country, from the cultures, languages, transportation, okay. lifestyle.
The infrastructure itself.
Yeah.
Well, then let's turn to the people a little bit. Population.
Okay.
Populated.
Yeah. So there are about 700,000 people in the country total. The biggest city is Thimphu, which has about 100,000. And then the next largest city has like 20,000 people. But all in all, it's like very rural.
Very rural mm-hmm. settings. Okay. Real quickly, the religion or so is mostly...
So the religion, the official religion of the country is Mahayana Buddhism.
Okay.
And the vast majority of people in the country are Buddhists, and it shapes everyday life.
Does it?
It shapes culture. It shapes environmental decisions.
Really?
Because of the sort of the main tenets of Buddhism.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Well,
yeah.
we can talk a little bit about that in a bit. Let's go to the infrastructure then. Is it first world base, third world? I mean, is running water, everyone have electricity? How does that look like?
It's mixed. And I think they're making a lot of progress on those fronts. I would still call it a developing country.
Okay.
Most places have running water of various qualities.
Could you drink it?
No.
No, you didn't drink
it. Yeah.
So you're drinking Fiji water? Bottles, giant bottles
filtered
of Fiji?
Water or bottled water or boiled water.
Okay.
Lots of water boiling.
So lots of tea.
Lots of tea. Oh, my gosh.
Bottled drinks.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. So, water, electricity.
So, electricity is something they're working on right now. And I heard pretty widely ranging statistics of what percent of people have electricity, from like mid-60s to like over 90% of the country. So, most people have electricity. The cities all have electricity,
okay.
But it's like the rural,
right.
Villages.
Not unexpected.
Homesteads. Yeah.
Or a little spottier.
Right. And so solar power is starting to become a better option for people. People are installing solar panels, and some of the NGOs are helping local
lots of
people
cell phones.
That.
Sorry, lots
yeah.
of cell phones.
Yeah,
sure.
Lots of cell phones.
So no phone. Not a lot of power. Well, there might be power lines, but no phone. Telephone poles or something. It's
right.
all cell based.
Yes, and it seems like just like here, cell phones are becoming more popular than house phones. A lot of places in Bhutan never had, you know, a phone line, and now people are using cells.
And then as a form of social media too,
mm-hmm.
for your phone.
But interestingly, Bhutan only got the internet and television in 1999.
Whoa!
It had been outlawed by the country. There was a ban on TV and internet.
No kidding.
And so it was brought there in 1999. Yeah. They have...
What?
I love Chris's face right
that's
now.
That's stunning.
But it is stunning. And they've kind of been a pretty isolated country, and a lot of that is by choice. Like,
sure.
they wanted to keep their culture strong
sure.
and their religion and their ideals. And
now,
you see that, and it still is really strong, but you definitely see that, like, westernization, mass media.
Sure. Now they're stuff. Watching reruns of Dallas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Okay. Why am I not surprised? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that but let's go back to electricity, because that's one of their exports, electricity.
Yeah.
Talk
it's
about
their,
that.
So hydropower, electricity, is their largest export and their largest source of revenue for the government of Bhutan. And it's a country that's like, I mean, the geography is built for it. You have these deep, steep canyons where you can, you know, relatively easily build a dam.
Mm-hmm.
But they have plans to like quadruple the amount of hydropower that they're creating. And the plans for most of that hydropower are to sell that to India, just like they're currently doing.
Right.
But that's also, you know, how they get a lot of their, most of their power inside the country. But that obviously, you know, has its environmental consequences and
yeah.
isn't uniformly popular.
So a lot of dams then?
A lot of dams are in the works and in the plans. We
no
saw a decent amount of like it kind of there it was like double tasking as like rock mining for dams, rock and sand mining, and road widening. So they would take the opportunity to widen the road. So that's where it seems like they're taking a lot of the stone and the
right,
sand from.
Right. So that presents environmental challenges.
Huge environmental
challenges. As any dams would.
Right.
Creating reservoirs.
Right.
Filling
a place
in,
that already has
canyons.
You know, river valleys are sort of, they're small and they're few and far between, and they're important habitat for, you know, birds and plants and whatever
right.
else. And so then those are going to disappear.
Okay.
Right. In some cases. So that's something that it was actually hard to get anybody to take a strong stance on. Like, people just seemed to say, that's the government policy. That's what's happening.
Right.
Even the environmental NGO said, I asked them about it. There's one environmental nonprofit in the country. And they said, you know, our stance on this is the middle path. We need to create, you know, a sustainable
Mahayana
living. We
Buddhism,
need to have
yes, Buddhism, the middle
yeah.
path.
We need to have, you know, income, but we also need to protect these habitats.
That's a classic.
So,
well,
the
that's
middle
the
path.
Classic situation.
Yeah.
It's jobs.
Right.
It's jobs, but it has consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's see. Oh, well, while we're on transport, you're talking about roads. How do you get around that country? Can you get around?
You can. The roads are difficult. They're like
– no interstates.
I almost four-wheel drive roads. So like the main road that crosses the country from east to west is like a winding, hilly, mountainous – parts of it are dirt, you know, pot-holy,
sure.
difficult road to
that
drive.
That classic image.
Exactly.
Of driving through that mountainous terrain.
Yeah.
Around tight
– oh, around tight bends and having to – you
one
know,
way traffic.
Back up to let somebody
other
else by
trucks.
And having to. Yeah, just, I mean, you're looking like off the side of. And I don't even want to say a cliff because it's just these steep slopes. And you're thinking, what if this dirt or this mud just like collapses, you know?
That'd be a bad day.
Yeah. Yeah. But it happens,
okay.
you know?
Yeah.
They have the mudslides and landslides and
okay.
avalanche paths.
So infrastructure in that sense is still a little bit backwards, but it sounds like it's improving because of the
right.
the dam building, the rock quarry.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're working on improving it, but historically, and until really recently, the primary mode of transportation was just to, like, walk. You just, like, walk over the hill to the next village or the next town. You know, you'd take your yaks or your ponies or your mules and walk somewhere, you know. We saw very few
your
horses.
2011 yak?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The new model.
Okay. So not a lot of personal car ownership or vehicle ownership.
Yeah,
there.
But again, that's like that's growing, especially in the city areas. Yeah. But people often don't take their cars on like the long trips. They'll find a bus or a truck or something to get a ride.
Okay.
Because a lot of cars are not going to make it over these roads. So
no. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Hey, if you just joined us, you're listening to This Green Earth, and we're speaking with Nell Larson, one of the co-hosts of This Green, who just came back from a extended trip. How long were you there now? You were
so I was in the country of Bhutan for just over 2 weeks, between 2 and 2.5 weeks, and then, you know, a couple of days on either end traveling.
And,
so.
And was this on your own or with a group?
So it was with a group. To get a visa into Bhutan, you have to actually register with an official, like a registered Bhutanese tour group. And the group that I went with was through the Yale School of Forestry, actually, mm-hmm. where I went. And they organized a partnership with one of the travel groups in Bhutan. And so it was actually a really interesting group of people to travel with.
Right. But is it easy to get into that country, or does it require an effort to get a visa?
I would say it's relatively easy. It's just understanding the process that you can't just like book a flight and show up.
Right.
You need to do some planning. But they, you know, I didn't have any trouble getting the visa or anything like that.
All right. So it's accessible. Mm-hmm. It's more accessible. Okay.
Their goal is not to sort of stymie tourism, but they want low impact, high value tourism. So they basically want everybody with a guide. And so depending on your guide, you may have more or less flexibility.
So they would prefer that spring breakers stay away.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So it hasn't reached that point. Mm-hmm. But tourism is an important part of their economy.
It definitely is. Okay. You see lodges, even like the trekking aspect, you know, employs a lot of people with their you know, their animals, their pack mules, their cooking. They, you know, it's a big industry there. It's important. There are a lot of people that want to be guides. That's kind of a sought after job.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break for some underwriters. When we come back, we're going to talk a little more about your trip there and turn towards some of the environmental issues, whether they're climate-related, endangered species-related. We'll touch on those things. It's This Green Earth, and we'll be back right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond with Republic Services, your recycling and garbage services provider and a proud supporter of KPCW. Recycling pickup in Summit County is now every other week. Remember, recycling materials go in your larger blue or brown bin. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Many know that Botox can help with migraines, but don't know where to turn for qualified headache care. Locally, Dr. Andy Talbot can help ease the life-altering headaches with Botox treatment. Park City Spine and Pain Clinic is an Intermountain Healthcare facility with highly skilled pain management providers. If migraines are a concern, they can help at 435-658-7470. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues. how we are connected to the environment, our impacts upon the environment, and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Co-host Nell Larson is back after a extended assignment. I was telling everybody that you were on assignment
I like
in Bhutan.
That. Yeah.
And you are, because now you're coming back and you're reporting about it.
That's right.
It sounds like a tremendous experience. We talked about the geography, the economy, a quick idea of the culture there, the infrastructure. Let's talk about the environmental setting. The monsoon season. They have a monsoon season. That just ended?
It did.
Talk
so the monsoon season is most of the summer. Like, the summer is hot and rainy. And the monsoon season just ended while I was there. And it ends on a day that becomes like a festival or a holiday day there that's called Blessed Rainy Day. And this day...
Right to the point.
Right, exactly. Generally, they consider it the last day of monsoon season, but it's also usually a really rainy day.
Oh.
And I was high in the Himalaya while this was taking place, up at about 13,000 feet. And I will say we got soaked. We got hailed on. We got poured on. There's a little bit of snow.
But supposedly, the wetter you get,
yeah, the more blessed you are. But there are lots of these like seasonal holidays and festivals and lots of lore surrounding them. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of your elevation, how high did you go up?
To 14,000 feet. Walking,
and that's kind of
trekking.
Like the foothills.
Yeah,
for the
that's
most
no
part?
Big deal. Like, people that are like, 14,000 feet. That's nothing. You know, they're running up these hills and we're all gasping
right.
for breath.
We're running up and then they come back down and ask you how you're doing and then they run back
right.
up.
Right, you doing okay?
Like a border collie. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. So the path that I trekked or backpacked was between Paro and Timpu. So you go up and over the mountains from one town down into the next.
So what kind of wildlife did you see?
Oh, I saw... blue sheep, which are a large ungulate that they have there that are pretty rare. They're not blue.
Okay.
We saw takin, which is the national animal, which is like referred to in a lot of different ways, like goat antelope, or they consider it a mix between a cow and a goat in their lore. It's a funny looking animal that's like taxonomically kind of unique.
Right.
And it really, I mean, it looks like a mix between like a goat and like a... I don't even know.
Really?
Yeah.
But it's a preserved species, or
what do you mean?
Protected?
Oh, it is protected as the national animal. And in Bhutan, most people avoid fishing and hunting because of their religion, because of the Buddhist religion.
Okay.
Yeah. So that isn't there isn't as much pressure on those kinds of things as there is here, which is probably good because they have like snow leopards, you know, and mountain lions and these rare, you know, cranes and birds and
any endangered or threatened species?
Yeah, they have the white-bellied stork, which has a tiny population, and they also have the black-necked crane, and that's probably the animal that I heard the most about while in the country. They're trying to protect it. They're working on improving the habitat for it, increasing the numbers. They do a lot of monitoring. They're working with the neighboring countries. You know, they're working with Tibet to try to, you know, like secure habitat in both places because,
right.
of course, it migrates.
Okay. So, all right. So, any sense of changes in climate going on there? Any trends or patterns that they're beginning to show up?
So there's definitely awareness of climate change and its potential impacts on the country. The country is really dependent on small farms, and climate obviously impacts small farms. I think the thing they think about a lot is water sources. You know, they get water from glaciers and
right.
snowmelt, you know, in addition to the monsoon. But they're not sure how that'll impact them. They're, you know, the environmental NGO in the country just did a climate vulnerability study to look at their, you know, sort of weaknesses and
right.
What they need to work on. There haven't been any sort of climate like disasters,
no,
I guess I would say. Right. It's not
this
like
this glacier has disappeared or this source
right.
of water is drying up or
right.
Nothing
that I learned about while I was there. But it's definitely on the conscious. People know about it. People are – the government and this NGO that's closely linked are thinking a lot about how it's going to impact them.
Well, one of the potential – excuse me, one of the potential benefits, I suppose, of this hydroelectric industry that's growing there is that you're going to have reservoirs, and reservoirs could be the potential source of water. No different than what we have here in that sense.
Right, right.
So it's one way, I guess, if you want to call it a positive consequence of damming these rivers.
There's a plan B, you know, a second source of water. You see, you know, the hillsides are just – it's these steep hillsides that are then terraced, and they grow like red rice. They grow turnips, buckwheat, mustard greens, and things of that nature.
What do they do with that?
They eat it. Let me tell you, I eat a lot of red rice.
Really? All right, real quick. Yeah. What's a typical day's food? Breakfast? Bagel?
You know,
H&H bagel?
I'm such a wimp about spicy foods. I was challenged with a lot of the food that they had there. They make some really spicy foods. One of their national dish, which is like a staple, like we're talking twice a day, is called emadatsi, and it's literally just hot peppers cooked in a cheese sauce, and you just eat it straight.
Ooh.
So, my diet had a lot of rice.
That's like lunch and dinner?
You'll have it like maybe at lunch and at dinner.
Okay.
You know, various meats, a lot of butter, like heavy foods. These are like – it's like a culture that came from living in the mountains and needing the calories, I think. You know, there's butter tea. It's like it's like a weak tea with like a big chunk of butter in it and some salt and sugar and – That's an acquired taste.
That sounds like things Americans would take too.
Right? Yeah.
Salt, sugar, butter. I think most fairs would be willing to serve that.
Yeah.
With your deep fried hot peppers.
Dough.
All right. Last minute or two. Overall impressions. Obviously you thought this trip was fantastic and worthwhile.
It was incredible.
All right. So you would suggest to others to go explore this, visit this country.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an incredible place. They have some environmental, you know, challenges, but all in all, they're way ahead of the game, especially ahead of any other developing country. They have like over half of their country set aside in protected areas. They, are managing their endangered species well. The awareness is really great. They are setting into place community forestry programs and community watershed programs and all manner of environmental education initiatives. So there's a lot happening on the environmental front, which is really interesting.
All right. Where can people go to online to learn more about? Where would you suggest they start?
I would suggest Googling the Royal Society for the Protection of Nature. And that's the environmental NGO that I've mentioned several times. And you'll start to get an understanding of the impact of Buddhism on their environmental management and some of the issues that this group is addressing. Where some of the funding for gross national happiness goes. So
we didn't even get to that.
Another time. That's right.
All right. Nell Larson, thank you very much.
Co-host.
Great conversation about Bhutan. Let's take a break. We'll post some information on our Facebook page about your trip, I'm sure. Okay. Well, let's take a break for a couple of underwriters. When we come back, we'll be talking all about moose in Utah. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond with Republic Services, your recycling and garbage services provider and a proud supporter of KPCW. Recycling pickup in Summit County is now every other week. Remember, recycling materials go in your larger blue or brown bin. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Join us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
From going gluten-free to finding your balance.
From bike position to relationship alignment.
From the educational journey to navigating wellness.
That's Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, and Grand Valley Bank.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, here with co-host Chris Cherniak across the board. And in the second half of the show, we are going to be talking about the moose population in Utah and how it's changed over the years. And here to tell us about that is Dr. Dan McNulty from Utah State University. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so let's start with a question that Chris and I both had.
Amazed.
Yeah, we were both surprised by something, and we have to ask, are moose native to Utah?
Well, yeah, they are native, but they're also fairly recent newcomers to the state. The first moose sighting in the state was in 1906, and they first got established on the north slope of the Uinta Mountains from dispersers from the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And so yes, they're native in the sense that they colonized the state naturally, but they've not been around for very long, for just over 100 years.
That was really kind of surprising to both of us. And we actually got a question from a listener who is wondering if they're spread throughout the rest of the state. Came from DWR, if the Division of Wildlife Resources has done some of this transporting of moose.
Some transplanting, yeah. So moose have colonized other areas of the state naturally, but they've also been transplanted by the Division of Wildlife Resources as well. So it's been a combination of both natural and man-made colonization.
Where have they been transported?
There was a group that were transported down to the Manny LaSalle. There were some that were transplanted to parts of the Ouray Uinta Reservation, sort of scattered here and there. There have also been moose transplanted into Colorado, actually. So about 112 moose have been transplanted to Colorado from Utah into Colorado. And so whereas at one time we were able to claim to be the most southerly sort of point in the natural distribution of moose, and I guess we could still claim that because moose here are natural for the most part, moose in Colorado are further south, and so they actually represent the sort of most southerly point in the range of moose, although that is a transplanted population. Nevertheless, they go down as far as southern Colorado now.
So what is the reasoning behind transporting these moose to new locations, yeah, I guess, to Colorado or new places?
It's driven, I think, largely by interests in, among those that are want to hunt moose. I think that's the primary motivation.
Sure.
Okay, that would have been my guess.
Yeah,
recreational opportunities.
And you know, and I think there's also an argument for transplanting moose simply, for the standpoint of sort of watchable wildlife. People enjoy seeing moose; they're fascinating animals. But I think one of the principal motivations is to sort of increase hunter opportunities.
Okay, so they've kind of either worked their way into the state or been transplanted in the state. How well have they succeeded in some areas versus other areas they haven't succeeded well?
Well, you know, for the most part in Utah, they have succeeded. And so moose really boomed throughout the 20th century. Their numbers increased sort of exponentially and sort of following kind of a classic sort of logistic growth curve that you'd expect of any sort of newly colonizing population into a habitat that was vacant of that particular animal. And so their numbers did very well for a long time, and then they started sort of leveling off. They started reaching what we think is carrying capacity, and that what we're seeing now is evidence of the population sort of bouncing around carrying capacity. What I mean by bouncing around is that they'll fluctuate. Some years they'll be above carrying capacity, some years they'll be below it. And what exactly is carrying capacity? Well, it's the number of resources that are available to support the population, essentially. And in some years, you're going to have more of those resources than in other years, and that's part of the reason why there's fluctuations. And Utah is interesting because, you know, we are, you know, the Wasatch Moose, for example, that's essentially a Great Basin habitat in terms of the vegetation and so forth. Yes, there's some Rocky Mountain flora in there. It's very different from the North Slope, but it's a very arid type of a climate. It's a very atypical climate for moose. You know, I talked to my colleagues who study moose in the upper Midwest, Alaska, and they scratch their heads, and they can't believe that there are moose that live in really, you know, brushlands, pinyon juniper. Sure, there's aspen and willow amongst the Wasatch, but there's a lot of arid vegetation types too, and it's really remarkable that moose are able to make a living in that habitat, but they're also, as a result, sort of on the edge.
Right.
And so any you know, major environmental fluctuation, whether it's a very dry year or very severe winter, you know, that can really, you know, cause the population to decline in a short period of time, potentially, because they are sort of on the ecological edge.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to ask, could the carrying capacity be slowly declining in response to climate change changing the, you know, the weather conditions here? So we've had a few really dry years.
Right.
We're also probably, you know, developing on some of their habitat, I'm guessing. Do you think these things are having a permanent impact on?
Well, so does carrying capacity change? Yes.
Right.
Is climate change a potential driver for that? Yes. You know, quantifying that is a difficult prospect, but I think it's a valid hypothesis. And for sure, development in moose winter range is a key limiting factor, right? So there's so much, you know, there's only so much winter range for moose available, and when that gets paved over or built over, it's no longer available to them. Although, of course, we know from our observations of moose in the, you know, in the Park City area that there's lots of moose living in people's backyards, practically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that's an issue. The other issue is traffic fatalities, you know, moose being hit by vehicles. That's also an important source of mortality. It is interesting to note, though, so we've radio collared, which is sort of standard radio transmitters, 120 moose, 60 on the Wasatch area, and then 60 in the North Slope. And survival rates have actually been quite high, between about 80, 85, 90%. We've only had a total of 15 mortalities since January, and that's out of 120. So despite these challenges, their survival, at least thus far from our monitoring, is fairly high. Now, it'll be interesting to see, you know, following all those moose through an entire winter and seeing how survival rates change from what we're seeing now. But so far, they seem to be fairly high in what we would expect of a population that is doing reasonably well.
What percentage of their mortalities would be, say, from natural enemies, mountain lion or what other besides man, other natural enemies they have?
Here in Utah, they don't really have any major predators.
Right.
Occasionally, yes, a mountain lion may take a young moose. Black bears are likely sources of mortality on young moose, as they are on other young ungulates, elk, deer, etc.
Mm.
Bears in general, grizzly bears, black bears, are major predators of what we refer to as neonates, newly born ungulates.
Mm.
Grizzly bears, for example, are huge predators of moose up in Alaska. And they're also major predators of elk up in the Yellowstone ecosystem. So there's likely some level of mortality from on the neonates, the young moose, from these predators. But once they reach, you know, 1 to 2 years of age, they really have very little predator-oriented or related mortality, we think. So far, we've not seen any.
Right.
We've seen moose that have apparently a diet of starvation, and this occurs in the late winter, early spring, so it's at the very end of the winter before green up occurs, And there's just not a lot of nutrition out on the landscape, if you will. And so they're running on fumes nutritionally. The
right.
fat reserves have been, you know, depleted over the course of the winter. So April and May tends to be the time where you see spikes in mortality. It's been documented elsewhere in the Rocky Mountains up in Wyoming. They've seen this spike in May. And then also we saw it as well here. We had six moose die in April, May of this year.
Hmm.
And then things sort of settle down again in terms of their mortality rate because forage becomes available.
Right.
And so the living is fairly easy.
So you currently have a research program going on that you've talked a little bit about, but give us the outline of this study.
Well, so it's really about testing the hypothesis that this population is being limited by the fact that they are at carrying capacity. What we're doing is that we're comparing the vital rates, birth rates and death rates, between two areas. One is the Wasatch area, and then one is the North Slope. And the reason why those two areas are significant is because they differ in the duration or the time at which that those populations were established, so the length of time that those moose have been on the ground in those two different areas. Moose, as I mentioned, on the North Slope, established about 100 years ago. So they have a fairly, you know, relatively long track record on the North Slope. And what that means is that they've been able to, they increased in numbers, they overshot what we probably think, or what they likely overshot carrying capacity, and they've come down, and now they're sort of bouncing around carrying capacity. Okay, so that's sort of an example of what we think is sort of the dynamics of an older settled population. Now, you take the Wasatch, though, they're a more recently established population, and they've not yet settled down around carrying capacity. What we think has happened is that they've increased beyond carrying capacity, and they're just now starting to adjust their numbers, and that what we think we're seeing is evidence of a decline that's due to adjusting their numbers to carrying capacity. And so given these two different scenarios, we're expecting differences in vital rates or birth and death rates between the two areas, primarily birth rates. Because the vital rates of a large ungulate population differ in their sensitivity to resource limitation. And what I mean by that specifically
Uh-oh.
Is that birth rates are the most sensitive, and survival rates are not. So we expect to see no difference in survival between the two areas, but we do expect to see a difference in birth rates, and we're actually seeing evidence of that.
What?
Fantastic. Sorry, we are experiencing a few little confusion here in the studio. Dan, are you still there?
I am still here.
Okay, great. So my question is, what was the motivation behind this study? Obviously, this is an interesting thing to look at and to learn about here in Utah, but what was the reasoning behind this study?
It's really simple. It's the concern that the population was in dramatic decline or is in dramatic decline across northern Utah. And so that's the primary motivation for the study. Are moose in decline, or are they just simply adjusting their numbers to the level of available resources?
And this is a partnership with the DWR, is that right?
That's correct, yep. So I'm working collaboratively with Kent Hersey at the Division of Wildlife Resources Office in Salt Lake City. And then in your area, in the Park City Heber area, I'm working with a gentleman named Dale Lichty, who is the wildlife biologist in that area, who's helping us oversee the radio tracking of moose down there.
Is there a way that the local citizenry can assist in, say, identifying moose or, you know, doing a moose count themselves or providing you some anecdotal information that might be helpful?
You know, I think what would be really helpful is if people find a dead moose
uh-huh.
that has a radio collar on it for them to report it to us, because that'll be one of our study animals, and we're really keen to check that animal out and assess cause of death. We don't want the public to approach these carcasses, but just simply report them.
Sure.
And then we'll go in and take a look and try to identify cause of death. That would be really helpful.
Okay.
So what do the radio collars look like?
Yeah.
And how do you get them on?
They're really not that impressive to look at. They're sort of got some nylon banding. That's the collar part, and then there's a little radio transmitter that's attached to the bottom of it, sort of like a little cylinder. And there's an antenna that wraps around the collar there that transmits the signal. And then as far as how do we get them on, we hire a capture company. Believe it or not, there are firms, companies that specialize in wildlife capture.
Wow.
For federal, state wildlife agencies. They swoop in a helicopter and they launch a net over the moose. And the moose becomes entangled in the net and becomes physically immobilized. And that allows the handler to go in and safely put the collar on the moose and then pull the net off, and off the moose goes. So there's no drugs, there's no chemical immobilization. It's just all physical restraining of the moose, and it's a safe process.
I hope it is safe.
For the moose.
The moose at least it's safe.
The handlers is a different story.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for those guys.
They take the risk. Okay.
For sure.
Any, we got a couple more minutes. Any surprises so far in some of the data you've been collecting? As far as, say, ranges or...
I think what's surprising to me, because I'm actually... I spent a lot of time in the Midwest, the University of Minnesota, where I did a lot of my graduate work, and my view of moose is sort of that classic boreal habitat. And so I think what's been really surprising for me is to see some of these moose in these sort of rocky canyon types of habitats, in the Taboo Mountain area, east of Heber City, and these really atypical moose habitats. That, to me, has been the most interesting aspect of all of this. So it's a neat opportunity to understand, the ecology of moose at the very southern extent of the range. And I think we stand to learn a lot about how moose respond to climate change by evaluating moose here, because elsewhere on the southern periphery of their range, in places like Minnesota, for example, moose are in dire straits because of climate-related changes in their habitat.
Wow.
So we think we can learn something about, how moose respond to environmental challenges by studying moose in places specifically like around Park City, Heber City, and Points East.
Okay. Well, got to wrap up. Any... suggestions where people can go to learn more about not only your research, but just a good site about moose.
Oh, wow. One of the best places to learn about moose, particularly if people have interest in the predator angle, is to visit the Isle Royale Wolf Moose Study website. There's a lot of information there about moose as well as predator-prey interactions involving moose, and so that would be a great place to go.
All right. And we ran out of time. We want to talk to you maybe another time about some of your research you're doing with wolves.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
We'll have you back to talk about that.
Absolutely.
Dan McNulty, he's an assistant professor within the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University. We really want to thank you for taking the time to chat with Nell and me about your work on moose.
My pleasure, Chris, and thanks so much for having me.
All right.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay.
Hey, let's take a... another quick break real quick and we'll come back. We got to hit that IPCC report summary. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond at Republic Services, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Gray is for garbage. Those four words will help you remember the current waste and recycling program. Your blue or brown bin is for recyclables. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Hola, soy Jorge, uno de los anfitriones de Cada Domingo. Escuche Cada Domingo en KPCW 91.9 FM todos los domingos en las tardes de las 7 a las 10 p.m. Tenemos música, información de la comunidad y perdidos y encontrados. Por favor, denle like o me gusta a la página Facebook de Cada Domingo. Cada Domingo, solo en Park City, solo KPCW. Hi, I'm Jorge, one of the hosts for KPCW's Cada Domingo. You can hear Cada Domingo every Sunday evening on KPCW 91.9 FM from 7 to 10 p.m., where you can hear music, community information, and lost and founds. Please like the KPCW Cada Domingo Facebook page. Cada Domingo, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We got a few minutes.
But first, we have a quick announcement.
Go get them.
Today, Tuesday, Rocky Mountain Power has scheduled a power interruption for Quarry Mountain between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. This may affect our broadcast area and the Summit County area. You can stream the broadcast live online at kpcw.org. That feed will not be interrupted. We just wanted to let you know.
That's right.
So now back to the IPCC report. It's the fifth assessment, Chris. What does that mean?
Well, that means it's the fifth in a series. There have been four previous reports from this. This is a Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's a voluntary organization of scientists whose job it is to study the climate. Okay,
so this pretty is pretty specific.
That's what they were educated to do, and that's what they do day in and day out: study the climate. And they get together occasionally, and they basically they. Write these reports are summaries of all the other research that's going on year in and year out on climate-related issues. And then they sit down and they sift through all these reports and they write a summary report.
And this is hundreds of scientists from all over the world.
All around 195 different countries have representatives on the IPCC panel. IPCC panel. And they released the fifth assessment report yesterday. The full report is some 2,000 pages long. There's a 30-page summary report that you can go online and get. Just search on IPCC summary report and you'll find a copy of that report.
And are there any major changes from the fourth assessment?
The biggest change is that they've gone from saying that climate change is very likely humans are very likely the cause behind climate change to extremely likely.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't sound like much to us, but to them it's going from like 90% certain to 95% certain that
which
it's
is a relatively
happening
big drum.
And that we are the primary source of this warming that's ongoing warming that's occurring. There have been some changes with respect to some of the temperature differentials that are being suggested, as little as 1.5 degrees centigrade mm-hmm. to 8 degrees centigrade within this century. Mm-hmm. But overall, the message remains the same. The planet is warming. They feel even more confident that it's occurring.
And we're
that,
doing it.
That humans, the burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, and deforestation, and all those other activities are resulting in more carbon dioxide, more methane, more nitrous oxide being released to the atmosphere. And that's serving to create the greenhouse effect, and that's warming the planet. There are some issues with respect to this temporary hiatus. You know what? We're going to go into that next week.
Yeah, we'll dig into the hiatus.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we've got to.
Where is the heat going?
Where is it going? Why is that happening? But we got to wrap up. We got to do one more break, and we'll come back and wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up. Again, thanks to Dan McNulty for coming on and talking about moose. That's a great conversation. Hope you go and out and learn more about it. We did not know they were
Recent arrivals,
yes.
We were both surprised by that.
And, of course, we always want to thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible without. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
Rocky Mountain Power.
San Francisco Design.
And Prudential Utah Real Estate.
And, of course, you can always follow us on Facebook.
That's right. Find us at KPCW This Green Earth. Like us if you like us.
And if you have any suggestions for topics you would like us to cover, You can always contact us there or to our email address.
That's right. thescreenearthradio@gmail.com is where you can reach Chris and me and give us your suggestions for future shows or feedback on recent shows.
All right. Again, thanks, Nell, for sharing with us your experiences you had in Bhutan.
It was a wonderful trip. I'm happy to.
We'll post that on Facebook. And again, thanks for joining us on This Green Earth. Remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.